Capitol Report is a production of Senate Media Services.
This week, freshman Senator Judy Seeberger talks about banning the non-essential use of forever chemicals and a new law to ensure qualified refinery workers. Plus, funding packages for public safety, education, and labor cross the finish line. Stay tuned for this week's Capitol Report. Welcome to this week's program. I'm Shannon Lurkey. All Republicans voted against and all DFLers voted for the Judiciary and Public Safety Budget Agreement, which is now headed to the governor's desk. The expansive bill includes a new early release program for prisoners who complete rehabilitation activities, a red flag law, and extended background checks for firearms transfers.
My concern has always been that there's a number of boards and commissions that have solely been given the majority of appointments from the executive branch. That's a concern. We are giving up our legislative authority.
When the bill left the Senate, we had established a definition for carjacking, but not only did we do that, it came with enhanced penalties, stiffer penalties than robbery. And for some reason, unbelievably, those enhanced penalties were stripped out.
The city of Victoria, Minnesota, which I represent, watched in horror as a man who molested several young girls in my district was placed in a neighborhood with hundreds of children. I put an amendment onto the original bill to direct DPS, when placing level 3 predatory sex offenders, to consider the density of children in a neighborhood, and to prevent them from placing these sex offenders near daycare centers. That amendment that I fought for my district and for all the children in Minnesota was removed.
The Minnesotans that I talk to think that there should be consequences for crime and consequences for violent criminals. Yet this bill before the body would make thousands of criminals convicted of serious and even violent crimes eligible for early release. That's not what I heard from Minnesotans on what they wanted to happen to violent criminals here in the state of Minnesota.
Law enforcement delivers the order and executes the firearm seizure without the accused even knowing the accusation has been levied against them. Not a word, not a phone call, nothing. You have an officer standing on your doorstep, Mr. President, and they're going to take your guns. This bill violates due process. The seizure of property without a warrant, especially that property that's protected by the Second Amendment, property protected by, guess what, the Bill of Rights. It's your right, members, to own these guns. It's your right. No hearing. No criminal act. No incompetency hearing. Just knock, knock, guess what? Someone said you're crazy, and we believe them.
We need to get after it and address the real problem, and that is mental health. It's already been talked about. Some of the decreased funding in this bill, things that were added previously and now have been removed. We keep taking things out of these bills that actually can go after the problem. And all we do is add more restrictions to law-abiding citizens. This infringement on our constitutional rights will not reduce crime. Criminals, again, do not obey laws.
This bill really is transformational. There's a holistic approach here to public safety, from the prevention to intervention, the resources for law enforcement and community groups to support victims of crime, holding offenders accountable. There's rehabilitation resources, and the redemption and restorative justice in this bill is just gonna do amazing things for Minnesotans.
But when we create a scary rhetoric where those people are scary, that means every single person, man, woman, and child needs a gun, and everything's a danger. It's not the 40s and 50s anymore when black people were still segregated away from white people, Mr. President. We gotta lock our doors now. We got to shoot kids who come and knock on our door looking for their little brothers and sisters through the door. Or the cheerleader who gets in her car on accident that wasn't hers. Or the young girl that was lost and turned around in a driveway and got shot.
We've heard a lot here today about the Second Amendment. And the fact is, no one is coming after the guns of people who are legal and safe and responsible.
We have to do something. And of all the things that have been brought this forward this session, in some ways I feel like these are definitely the least onerous of things we can do, that they could make a small incremental change. I think they are worth trying.
Gun owners want nothing more than to reduce gun violence. But the responsibility of gun ownership is just one of the responsibilities that I have. My most important responsibility is that of being a father. What I know is I cannot look my kids in the eye and say that there is nothing I could do to keep them safe.
There's been a lot of concern raised and numbers cited about the number of people that would be eligible for early release, 7,400 people out of the 7,500 people in our prison system might get released early. And you know what? I hope they create their own eligibility to be released early, because that's 7,400 people who have an incentive to improve themselves.
At least two bills sponsored by Senator Judy Seeberger have crossed the finish line or soon will. One that will phase out the non-essential use of PFAS, or forever chemicals, is expected to be included in an omnibus package. The second, to improve worker safety at refineries, is already law. She joins me now to talk about the legislation. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure.
So you mentioned at a press conference that your personal well contains PFAS, and because of that, you use a water filtration system. A lawsuit by the state of Minnesota against 3M over groundwater contamination in the Southeast Metro, which is your district, resulted in an $850 million settlement. Do you view your district as a kind of canary in the coal mine when it comes to PFAS contamination and the possible impacts on human health?
Yeah, I absolutely do. We've seen the effects of PFAS in my district, which is on the east side of the metro. And early on, efforts were taken using that 3M money to remediate municipal wells and private wells within my district. We've seen it up in the northern part in Lake Elmo, down through Afton where I live, in Cottage Grove. And more recently now, with the lowering of the acceptable thresholds of PFAS, we now have Hastings within the community of areas that now is affected by PFAS. So we're seeing the acceptable thresholds get lower and lower and lower. And while that happens, more and more communities are being impacted by PFAS contamination. I think what we're seeing within my district, we're going to start seeing statewide as we discover additional areas of PFAS contamination and looking at the effects that it has on our residents.
There are an enormous number of products that contain PFAS chemicals, carpet, textiles, cosmetics, menstrual products, ski wax, and more. If this bill becomes law, what will manufacturers be required to disclose come January 1st, 2025?
Right, so the law has new labeling requirements. So if something contains PFAS, it's going to be reflected on the labeling. It's going to notify the consumer that this product contains PFAS. Of the products that you mentioned, those are within my bill to ban PFAS in those particular products. I think when folks think about PFAS, I always kind of defaulted to the Scotchgard and the Teflon pans and things like that. But when you start thinking about our stain-resistant carpets, that's the PFAS technology. Dental floss, of all things, something that we use every single day, potentially introducing this substance into our bodies. So the labeling requirements, so as a consumer, you're going to know what you're getting. And then going further to ban PFAS in a lot of those consumer products.
So manufacturers will have the choice to make to either just completely eliminate the use of the PFAS or to say it contains it in this product. Does it have to say how much it contains? Are there different kinds? How do we know the level of use of the product, of the chemical in the product?
Right. In my view, no level of PFAS is safe. I think what we're finding with the constantly lowering of the threshold, that we're discovering that really no level is safe. What I've learned is that these chemicals are bioaccumulating, which means they build up in your system over time. So even at minuscule levels, it never leaves your body. We saw the powerful testimony of Amara Strandi, which I think gives voice to the potential health effects that exposure to these chemicals can cause.
And we should say that Amara Strandi testified before multiple committees and then died before her 21st birthday of a cancer that she attributed to PFAS contamination.
Right, yeah. Her testimony was powerful, and it's really heartbreaking that she didn't live to see this law get across the finish line. I think, again, no level of PFAS is safe within our bodies, and I think it's up to the consumers to make that choice, whether they want to use a product that has PFAS in it or not.
Well, and there is a distinction in the bill between essential and non-essential. I know that the chemical exists in firefighting foam. What is an essential use? What is a non-essential use?
Yeah. You know, it's kind of industry specific with regard to whether it's considered essential use or non-essential use. There's some medical products that use it that there simply is no alternative. Let's say, for example, a stent for your heart, mm-hmm. Or some prosthetic uses. And since there is no alternative in some of these other uses that are essentially life-saving uses, there has been language included in the bill to exempt those products unless and until an alternative can be found. In the case of firefighting foam, it was really a couple of industries that argued the loudest that this was an essential use. And I don't necessarily agree that firefighting foam without PFAS is less effective or more dangerous than the type with the PFAS. There's certainly arguments to be made on each side. But I did have long conversations with the firefighting industry and firmly believe that that firefighting foam without PFAS is just as effective as the dangerous stuff.
Minnesota will be leading the nation if this bill becomes law. Do you expect other states to follow our lead?
I do, and I would hope that they would. PFAS was invented here in Minnesota, and I think it's our duty to come up with a solution and come up with these laws that ban it in all areas. So I would hope that we are a leader and an example for the rest of the country when it comes to banning these products.
So now let's turn to the refinery bill. You were also Senate sponsor of now a new law that will require, or does require, over time, a certain level of training for workers who work in refineries. And I remember the floor session several years ago when your predecessor, Senator Carla Bigham, offered this as an amendment that passed and then was clawed back later. It took a little while to get this bill into law. How come?
Well, nothing much happened in the last few sessions. We saw gridlock and things grind to a halt. So even though my bill had bipartisan support, I think it passed the Senate with 39 votes, which included Republicans and Democrats alike, just the nature of the prior sessions, nothing got done. So I'm proud to have this pass through as a standalone bill and finally make its way through so that our workers in oil refineries can be as safe as they possibly can.
The training requirement that this law has is phased in over time with a maximum of 60% then of contracted workers. They'll be required to meet training requirements by the year 2026. So considering that there is a workforce shortage, does this law possibly make it harder for refineries to find enough qualified employees?
I would argue that it does not. What we saw and the origins of this bill came from refinery workers. It came from workers at the Marathon Refinery seeing unqualified, underqualified workers come in from out of state, which really put all of their lives in jeopardy. I think that it's not worth the cost to bring in untrained, undertrained, unqualified workers in a facility like an oil refinery where so much can go wrong. In fact, we saw it earlier this year. The Marathon refinery had a spill of molten asphalt. Somebody was working on a valve, didn't do something correctly, and it resulted in, I want to say it was 20,000 gallons of molten asphalt spilling, two workers injured that had to go to the hospital. That's not okay. And that's exactly what my bill, now law, is meant to address. To the extent that there's a workforce shortage, everybody's seeing a workforce shortage, but we have wonderful trades programs that can train people to do this work safely and at a minimum threshold of training, which is our apprenticeship level. But it's not just a union bill. Anybody can establish a registered apprenticeship program. So the refineries themselves can do it and really bring our safety training and our worker training to this gold standard, this minimum threshold of training. So I don't buy it that there's a worker shortage and this is going to aggravate this. Instead, what it's going to do is it's going to raise the floor and make everyone safer in these refineries.
And does this then potentially make it better for workers too, because they're more highly qualified and can earn a higher wage?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a win-win all the way around. You know, as an oil refinery, do you want to spend your time cleaning up spilled molten asphalt and dealing with accidents that happen because you have underqualified or unqualified workers? Or would you rather pay people what they're worth, have qualified workers in there, and have a plant that runs safely and effectively? So I think it's a win for everyone.
Senator Judy Seeberger, it's been a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Monday morning, prior to the Senate taking up the omnibus jobs and labor agreement, key DFLers and worker advocates highlighted provisions in the package.
Now that we are in charge and we're going to write a beautiful, meaningful, powerful labor bill. And so we opened the door, we sent invitations throughout the state to workers, to labor unions, organizers, and we said, bring us the things that you've been working on for a while that you've wanted to see get across the finish line, because this year we're going to do that.
What happened to myself during my work in Hormel time, I lose my fingertip because of some few accidents happened there.
Parents should not have to send their kids to daycare with a fever, praying they won't get the call to come pick them up while they're on the clock because they can't afford to lose pay. Workers shouldn't have to choose between going to work sick or being able to make rent or buy groceries that week. And as we saw in the COVID-19 pandemic, choices like that have a huge impact on public health and affect all of us. No one should have to choose between a paycheck and having the time to care for themselves or a loved one.
This bill is going to be a huge step towards ensuring we can keep nursing home workers and residents safe. This will be the first standard board in the country covering nursing homes that has the authority to cover pay and benefits. This is huge for the safety and stability of our industry.
Every 2 years, union educators negotiate contracts with their employers, which usually are public school districts. I've been doing this and I'm currently involved in talks for my 12th contract period. These contracts cover things like wages and sick days and evaluations and other working conditions. The bill going to the Senate floor today would expand those subjects to include staff to student ratios, which is similar to what most people think of as class sizes. When the Senate passes this language, it means that our families, our students, could have written promises about one of the most important learning conditions in their schools. Will your kindergartner be in a class of 18 students or 28?
While I was working as a nurse aide, my coworkers and I decided to organize a union. And that's all well and good, but management seems to think differently whenever that happens. This Management's opposition to workers forming a union can be put into three different categories. Refusal to bargain, a complaint about democracy, or a flat-out lie. And over about 6 weeks, I was subject to all three of those in meetings which I could not get out of as an employee. Now, as an employee, saying no to your boss is a radical thing. And when the boss sits you down and explains to you why you should not do a thing, it's scary to say no. And that's why these protections in banning captive audience meetings, or at least making them non-compulsory, is so important.
As powerful as corporations are, and they are powerful actors in our communities, in this legislature, and across the state in our economy, we need to make sure that the people who work for a living are equally powerful, so they're able to work, support their families, and come home at the end of the day safe, able to do the things that make up the rest of their lives.
As a Amazon worker working there, what I experienced, it was so unfair how people was treated, especially people who didn't understand their rights. The company was not teaching people their rights. So this bill means a lot to all the warehouse workers in Minnesota, especially Amazon, the way they treat and the way people work there with the rates now. Being there, working there, I noticed a lot of people feel a little bit more comfortable. They don't push us with the rates like they used to. Like, they're changing things, but we don't know how long that's going to last. So this bill means the world to us. Just knowing that I don't have to worry about, you know, calling in sick if I'm sick. I don't have to worry about being under surveillance, which is TOT, time of task. I don't have to worry about going to my prayers and rushing to pray, not worrying like, oh, I'm going to go back and get in trouble.
As the legislative session comes to a close, we'd like to take a moment to spotlight the work of our Senate photographers, A.J. Olmscheid and Michelle Jokinen. Hours of the morning, the Senate passed the Omnibus E-12 education package, which is now headed to the desk of Governor Walz.
I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of disappointed teachers, unfortunately, here in the state of Minnesota when we started session with a $19 billion surplus and we're talking about ways to attract and retain teachers into the profession, and we can't really make any progress on teacher pension reform. And I guess, Mr. President, I kind of unfortunately saw that we were likely headed this way when Governor Walz came out with his budget recommendation and again had exactly $0.00 for teacher pension reform.
Democrats promised, and they're still talking about how they fully funded schools, but instead they're imposing a huge number of mandates onto our schools that will prevent any additional investment from making it into the classroom. Many schools, we had a press conference down here, a couple of my superintendents were here, they told us that these mandates and these bills moving through the Capitol are going to cost them more money than they are receiving in this education bill. We should be giving these schools more flexibility with their dollars so they can meet the needs of the students in their districts.
I'm sure ethnic studies will teach a wide array of culture and tradition, including subject that talks about my backgrounds. I said it before that I am a proud American but my Hmong culture, language and history, and tradition are fading away faster than we know. Many centuries ago, Laos in particular was where Hmong helped America during the Vietnam War, then faced persecution and genocide, causing us to exile here. This is our trail of tears, and it needs to be taught in classroom today.
What we know is our students are behind in reading, math, and science right now. Our main focus needs to be getting our students caught up to where they belong so that they can be on a path to a successful future. So many of the new requirements in this bill are going to take the attention away from our folks in our schools and distract them from being able to focus on getting our kids caught up in reading, math, and science. The historic funding is wonderful if it had been focused on the classrooms.
We have funded the cross-subsidy, special education cross-subsidy at about 6% over the last few years, decades in fact. This bill will fund it at 44% in this biennium and 50% in the next one. ELL funding is increased by $87 million. The general ed formula is going to give each school 4% on the formula, which will increase the number of per student from $6,800 to $7,100. Last 6 years, we've been funding transportation sparsity in rural Minnesota at 18%. We're doubling that to 35%. School districts don't, for one renewal of a referendum, will not have to ask the taxpayers as long as the school board wants to renew it. And lastly, I just want to remind everybody that menstrual equity for our students is going to be a pretty big deal.
I feel like this is a really good bill. It centers the student. It centers the classroom. There are resources in there that are going to make a huge difference for our students. And that's really where our heart of the matter is. It's with our students. Senator Swedzinski and I, both former teachers, recognize that we have a sometimes a different view of what we think would work best for our schools, and while we would love to fully fund our schools 100%, I think the reality, and everybody here knows that that's not possible now, and it might not ever be possible, and it certainly is the responsibility of the communities as well to fund, partner in the work of funding our schools and supporting our schools and ensuring that our schools succeed.
Join us again next week as we delve into more topics affecting Minnesotans. I'm Shannon Lurkey, and on behalf of all of us at Senate Media Services, thanks for watching.